Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, friends.
Good evening. Welcome to the Bard's Grove,
where the tales of mystery and magic,
yeah,
and so much more can be heard every week.
Every week.
Welcome,
hey,
friends.
How are you?
Very good, very good. Let me silence our drummer friends and wish all our guests an evening a wonderful journey with us. What's new in the sky, Kat?
Well, you know, we had the new moon in Aquarius last Monday, along with the Chinese New Year, which was sort of the emotional, you know, body New Year, I guess you could say, because the Chinese are on a lunar calendar. But and then we've had a lot of solar flares. People have been reporting in, telling me how miserable they've been feeling all week because of it. You know, it affects the electromagnetic fields, right? Isn't that what they do?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So anyway, the big thing I think for people would be that Mars is retrograde, and so if you're trying to hurry along and finish, you know, and get projects off the ground, I think that it's time to process things a little more, go in and find out if this is what you really want, if all of it's necessary. You know, sometimes we have big ideas and we want to start all at once everything, and maybe in this time in our society it's better to plant small and what the essence is, you know. So what's the essential thing you want to do? And because, you know, next week is already in bulk, it's already Candlemas, it's a turning of the wheel of the year. Everybody's going to notice after next week that it's going to get lighter out, which is nice. And it's a time of visioning, so this is a good week to use that Mars that's going inside you to vision who you really are and what you really want.
Wow, it sounds interesting. Always interesting sky weather that we hear from you. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Oh, you're welcome.
So do you have any seminars coming up, dear, or any classes you're offering?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm starting a couple of dream groups starting on Monday the 6th. We're going to do them online, probably with Skype, although who knows, maybe we'll do some on Bard's Talk Radio too. And because dreams are the most important, I mean, it's really fun and it's interesting and it's helpful to know what the cosmic weather is. But that's telling us what the collective energy is. If you know your chart and you can hook up what's happening in the cosmic arena at the moment to your chart, that helps you even more. But the most beneficial thing anyone could ever do in their life is pay attention to their own dreams. They have so much they're telling us.
So many teachers have said that. I've read it again and again from all different kinds of disciplines.
Well, it's, to me, dreams come from our soul. They are from the great self, and they tell us this is what's really going on, rather than what the ego thinks is going on. And so I think it's, instead of people come and want readings and tarot readings, or they go and they ask advice of their friends over and over again, and yet my experience with my own personal life and the people I work with is dreams get you right on target. You don't need to go to a psychic or a gypsy to find out how your year is going to be. Just pay attention to your dreams.
Well, I've been keeping dream journals since the 70s. And I know that if I pay attention to the metaphors, to the symbols that I'm using, I can almost always tease a message or an insight from that information. I think if you pay close attention, you may not get it that day, but it always offers you insight into what you're trying to process.
Yeah, it does.
Well, I think it's story time. What do you think, Kat?
I think it's story time, too. So I would say to you, what would you like to tell? What story would you like to tell?
I've got a most unusual tale from ancient Moldavia.
Ooh.
The mountains are the Carpathian Mountains, and here we go on a little bumpy ride with the useless Wagoneer. There was once in the world a king, and he had a useless Wagoneer who never and never did anything but frolic in the tavern. The whole standing day and all the ocean great night, there was nothing for him but singing and dancing and eating and drinking. The king had money, of course. But the king began to grow tired of this thing. He called up the useless Wagoneer and gave him a terrible scolding. But 'tis vain to seat a dog at the table. And when the devil gets into a man, he stays there. So it was labor lost to drive the useless Wagoneer to work, for he went his way and frolicked as before. At last the king resolved to take his life, and calling him up said, "Dost hear me, work-shunning useless Wagoneer? I revile thy mother. And if within the turn of 24 hours thou dost not make for me a 300-gallon cask, and though one joint or seam is not much, if it has that, I'll impale thee on a stake." The useless Wagoneer said not a word to all this, but he put a hamper on his back. He took a cutting axe in his hand and strolled off to the forest to find a tree fit to make a 300-gallon cask. When he came to the forest, being hungry and tired, he sat down under a large shady tree, opened his hamper, and began to eat lunch. He ate and he ate till all at once from some corner or another a little fox stood before him and begged food to eat. "Of course I'll give thee something. The food came here, 'twill stay here." And with that, he threw a slice of bread and a bit of sausage to the fox. When the fox had finished eating, she said, "Dost hear, useless Wagoneer? As thou hast taken pity on me, I will take pity on thee. In place of a good deed, look for a good deed. Though thou hast not told me, still I know why thou hast come to the forest. I know, too, that the king is breaking his head to kill thee, but he'll not be in time, for I will help thee out of thy trouble and make thee the 300-gallon cask. And though one seam or joint is not much, even that will not be in it. Now lie down and rest." And so it was. The useless Wagoneer laid down and rested. Meanwhile, the little fox got such a 300-gallon cask ready that although a joint or seam is not much, even that was not to be seen in it. When the cask was finished, the useless Wagoneer took it home, gave it to the king, who, after looking carefully at it, dropped his eyes and slipped like a sheep, for neither his father, his grandfather, nor his great-grandfather had ever seen such a cunningly made cask. Not a seam nor a joint could be seen in it for all the gold in the world. Well and good for the moment, but soon the king summoned the useless Wagoneer to his presence again and cried out, "Dost thou hear me, work-shunning useless Wagoneer? I revile thy soul if within the turn of 24 hours thou dost not make for me a chariot which will go itself without horses. I'll break thee on a wheel." Well, the useless Wagoneer said nothing, put his hamper on his back, took his cutting axe in his hand, and wandered off to the forest to find a tree fit to make a chariot. When he came to the forest, he was hungry and tired too, and therefore he sat down under a large shady tree. He opened his hamper and began to eat lunch. He ate and he ate until all at once, from some corner or another, the little fox stood before him again and begged food to eat. "Well, of course, dear little fox, I'll give thee something. I came here, my food, and it will stay here." And with that, he threw a piece of bread and a slice of ham to the little fox, who, after she eaten, said, "Well, useless Wagoneer, in place of a good deed, look for a good deed. though thou hast not told me, still I know why thou art here. I know, too, that the king is breaking his head to kill thee, but he won't, for I shall help thee out of trouble. I'll make for thee a chariot which will go of itself without horses, but do thou lie down and rest. So it was. The useless wagoneer reclined his head in rest, and meanwhile that little fox fashioned a chariot beautifully. When all was ready, she roused the useless wagoneer and said, "Here is the chariot, which runs of itself, though thou hast but to step in and command it to stop in the king's courtyard. But I would tell thee this, here is a whistle that will serve thee. Shouldst thou fall into trouble, just blow, it will help thee." The useless wagoneer thanked the fox for her kindness and entered the chariot, which stopped not until it reached the king's courtyard. When the king saw the chariot, he could say nothing, but he shook his head and he turned on the useless wagoneer in a rage and cried, "Useless wagoneer, I revile thy mother. In my stable there are 100 hares, and if thou dost not herd them 3 days, if thou dost not drive them afield in the morning and bring them back at night, so that not one shall be missing from the 100, I'll strike off thy head." Well, what was the poor useless wagoneer to do? Against his will and of need, he let the 100 hares out of the stable and drove them afield. They had barely touched the edge when they ran in as many directions as there were hares. Who could bring them together again? Well, the poor useless wagoneer ran first after one, then after another, then a third, then a fourth. He chased a whole day, but he could not bring back a single hare. It was already growing late, time to go home, but the 100 hares were in 100 places. Therefore, the useless wagoneer became terribly sad, and he wished to make an end of his own life. It was all the same, whether he or the king took it. There was no salvation for him, anyhow. So he put his hand in the bosom to take out his clasp knife and strike himself to the heart. But instead of the knife, he found the whistle, which the little fox had given him. And that was all he wanted. He drew out the whistle, sounded it, and behold, all the hares ran up to him, as tame as pet lambs, fed from the palm of his hand. Where did all the hares come from? It didn't matter. He drove them home. The king stood at the gate. He let them in singly, counting 1, 2, 3, 99, 100. Not one was missing. The next day, the useless wagoneer drove the hares out again, and when they had barely reached the edge of the field, they ran off in as many directions as there were hares. But this time, the useless wagoneer took no thought of running and chasing after them. He thought to himself that he would just take his whistle and blow, and they would come. So he laid down in a nice shady place and slept to his liking. But the king did not sleep. He was racking his brains to destroy the useless wagoneer. So he called his one and only, his dearly beloved daughter, and said to her, "My darling daughter, I have a great favor to ask of thee." "What may it be, my father the king?" "Well, of a truth, nothing but this, that thou dress in peasant's clothes and go out into the field where the useless wagoneer is herding the 100 hares, and beg one of him. If he give it not for a good word, mayhap he will give it for a sweet kiss. But come not home to me without the hare, and even if he asks a piece of thy body for it." The princess granted her father's request. She gathered her wits about her, dressed up in peasant's clothes, and went in the field to the useless wagoneer, who was sleeping at his leisure under a shady tree. The princess pushed him, kicked him with her foot. He woke, and he saw in a moment with whom he had to deal. "God give thee good day," hare heard. "God save thee, king's daughter. What dost thou bring the poor hare heard?" "I have brought nothing but this. I have come because I would like to get one little hare. Would thou not give me even one for good money?" "Hi, princess, I will not give thee one for money, but if thou wilt give me 3 kisses, and I can give them back, then I don't mind. I'll give thee a hare." So the princess got a hare for 3 kisses and ran home very joyfully. But just as she was touching the latch to open the gate, the hare herd sounded his whistle. The hare jumped like lightning from her bosom and stopped not until it reached the flock. Well, the hare herd drove home his flock, and the king was waiting for him at the gate, and he let them in, one by one by one, counting till he came to 100. Well, the next day, the hare herd drove out his hares for a 3rd time, and he let them go their way. Well, the king now called his wife to the white chamber and spoke thus to her, "My heart's beautiful love, I have a great favor to ask of thee."
"What may it be, my husband?"
"Of a truth, nothing but this, that thou dress in peasant's clothes, go to the hare herd in the field, and ask for a hare of him. If he will not give it for fair words, he may for sweet kiss. But come not home to me without a hare, even if he asks a piece of thy flesh." Well, the queen yielded to her husband's request, put on a peasant's dress, and went to the field, where she found the useless wagoner sleeping in the shade. She roused him with her foot. He knew at once who was in the peasant's dress. "God give thee good day, hare herd."
"God save thee, kind queen."
"What good hast thou brought the poor hare herd? Why hast thou come, may I ask?"
"I have only come to ask if thou wilt give me a hare for good money."
"I will not give thee a hare for money, my queen, but if thou wilt give me 3 kisses, I will return them again.
Then I don't mind. I'll risk my head and have thee have a hare."
So the queen got a hare for 3 pairs of kisses and took her way. But as she was putting her hand on the latch to open the gate, the hare herd sounded the whistle. The hare jumped like a flash from the queen's bosom and didn't stop until it reached all its companions. And when the hares were all together, the hare herd drove them home. The king was waiting for him at the gate. He let in each one, one by one, counting till he reached 100. Not one was missing from the round number. The next morning, the hares were driven out as before, but the king now put on a peasant's dress and went to the field himself. And when he came to the hare herd, he said, "God give thee good day.
God save thee, poor man," answered the hare herd.
"What art thou looking for?"
"Well, what's the use in delay or denial? I have come to buy a little hare of thee for good money.
Of course thou wilt part with one."
"I will not give one for money, but if I can wear out 12 rods on thy back, I don't mind. I'll risk my head on it."
Well, what was the king to do? He stretched himself out with face and hands on the ground, and the hare herd flogged him as a corporal does a soldier. But he endured it all, getting his teeth and thinking to himself, "Wait a bit, thief of a useless wagoner, thou wilt have a dose when I get at thee." But all to no use, for when the king had reached home and was just putting his hand on the latch to open the gate, the whistle sounded, the hare sprang away from him like a flash and ran until it joined the rest of the flock. Then the useless wagoner drove home the 100 hares a 4th time. The king was standing at the little gate. He counted them one by one by one by one and could find no fault, for they were all there. The useless wagoner drove out the hares a 4th time to the pasture. But the king mounted the chariot, which went wherever the owner commanded, and he drove to the useless wagoner, taking 3 empty bags with him.
"Dost hear me, thou, this and that kind of work-shunning hare herd? I revile thy sore. If thou wilt not fill these 3 bags with truth, I will strike off thy head."
Well, to all this, the useless wagoner answered in words, "The king's daughter came out. I gave her, and she gave me. The queen came.
I gave her, and she gave me. The king came. I gave him. And stop! Stop! Cried the king. The three bags are full. I'd rather be in hell than hear thy words. And at this speech, the chariot started off with the king. And it never stopped till it took him to the bottom of hell. Then the useless wagoneer went home, married the king's daughter, became king, and he reigns yet with his queen, unless he's dead.
Sometimes these stories are so interesting, aren't they?
I'll tell you, that was a new one on me. I hadn't heard this one.
Well, you know, there's the simpleton, there's these archetypal figures. I had never heard of the useless wagoneer, but he comes in like the trickster and the dumbling.
They're Rhinothor?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking of doing an Arthurian tale from one of the Knights of the Round Table, since to me Aquarius is that, the image for Aquarius to me is the Round Table.
Sure.
It's when we're all sitting there as equals, ladies and men, knights and ladies, and we bring our gifts and talents for the betterment of the kingdom. So all of these wonderful tales from about the Knights of the Round Table, they're quests that people have to go on. And this is a story called The Lady of the Fountain. It's one of the heroes of Arthur's, Owen is one of the heroes of Arthur's, of the tales. And he has to stand up for something. And I love the fact that it's a fountain. And so we could say, oh, look, how do we stand up for the water? And what happens sometimes when we stand up for the water? Sometimes we forget. Sometimes we let things slide. So this is a wonderful little story. The tale of the Lady of the Fountain. I'm going to just take one drink of water quickly since I haven't done it.
Well, it's only fair. I mean, after all, the Lady of the Fountain, right?
That's right. The Undines. Okay. So in the center of the great hall in the castle of Carleon upon Usk, King Arthur sat on a seat of green rushes, over which was thrown a covering of flame-colored silk, and a cushion of red satin lay under his elbow. I love these old tales. They're so rich with sensual imagery. Like the Arabian Nights, they'll go on and on describing these beautiful flame-colored silk, red satin, wonderful.
I mean, anyway, if you think about it, here you've got somebody telling a story to people who've seen none of this stuff.
Right.
So they've got to paint the most elaborate, ornate, Baroque figures, you know, with their words. They're so rich. I love, when I read these stories, the metaphors, you know, an ocean-wide night. My God, how cool is that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Read on, my dear. Read on.
We need to reclaim the sensuousness, I think, too. Anyway, with him were his knights Owen and Caemon and Kay, while at the far end, close to the window, were Guinevere the queen and her maidens, who were embroidering garments. "I'm weary," said Arthur. "Until my food is prepared, I would go to sleep. You can tell each other tales. And you, Kay, why don't you fetch from the kitchen some mead and some meat?" And so when the knights had eaten and drunk, Kynon, the oldest among them, told his story. "I was the only son of my father and mother, and much store they set by me, but I was not content to stay with them at home, for I thought no deed in all the world was too mighty for me. None could hold me back, and after I had won many adventures in my own land, I said goodbye to my parents and set out to see the world. Over mountains and through deserts, across rivers I went, until I reached a fair valley full of trees, with a path running by the side of a stream. I walked along that path all day, and in the evening I came to a castle, in front of which stood two youths clothed in yellow, each grasping an ivory bow, with arrows made of the bones of a whale and winged with peacock feathers. By their sides hung golden daggers with hilts of the bones of the whale. Now near these young men was a man richly dressed, who turned and went with me towards the castle, and all the dwellers were gathered there in the hall. In one window I beheld 24 damsels, and the least fair of them was fairer than Guinevere at her fairest. Some took my horse, others unbuckled my armor and washed it with my sword and spear till it shone like silver. And then I washed myself and put on a vest and doublet, which they brought me. And I and the man that entered with me sat down before a table of silver and a friendlier feast I had never had. Now all this time neither man nor maiden had spoken one word, but when our dinner was half over and my hunger was stilled, the man began to ask who I was. Then I told him my name and my father's name, and why I came there. For indeed I had grown weary of gaining the mastery over all men at home, and so sought a chance of perchance that there was one who could gain mastery over me. At this the man smiled and said, "If I did not fear to distress you too much, I would show you what you seek." His words made me sorrowful and fearful of myself, which the man perceived, and so he added, "If you mean truly what you say and desire earnestly to prove your valor, and not to boast vainly that none can overcome you, I have somewhat to show you. But tonight you must sleep in this castle. Don't worry about it. And in the morning, see that you rise early and follow the road upwards through the valley until you reach a wood. In the wood is a path branching to the right. Go along this path until you come to a space of grass with a mound in the middle of it. On the top of the mound stands a black man, larger than any two white men. His one eye is in the center of his forehead, and he only has one foot. He carries a club of iron, and two white men could hardly lift it. Around him graze 1,000 beasts, all of different kinds, for he is the guardian of that wood, and it is he who will tell you which way to go in order to find the adventure that you are looking for." So spoke the man, and long did that night seem to me. And before dawn I arose and put on my armor and mounted my horse and rode on till I reached the grassy space of which he spoke. There was the black man on top of the mound, just as he said, and in truth he was mightier in all ways than I had thought him to be. As for the club, Kay, it would have been a burden for four of our warriors. He waited for me to speak, and I asked him what power he held over the beasts that thronged so close about him. "I will show thee, little man," he answered, and with his club he struck a stag on the head until he brayed loudly. At his braying, the animals came running, numerous as the stars in the sky, so that scarcely was I able to stand among them. Serpents were there, and dragons, and beasts with strange shapes, with horns in places where never I saw horns before. And the black man only looked at them and bade them go and feed, and they bowed themselves before him as vassals before their lord. "Now, little man, I've answered your questions and showed you my power. Is there anything else you want to know?" And when I inquired of him my way, but he grew angry, and as I perceived, he would have hindered me. But at the last, after I had told him who I was, his anger passed. "Take that path that leads to the head of this grassy glade, and go up the woods until you come to the top. There you'll find an open space, and in the midst of it a tall tree. Under the tree is a fountain, and by the fountain a marble slab, and on the slab a bowl of silver with a silver chain. Dip the bowl in the fountain and throw the water on the slab, and you'll hear a mighty peal of thunder till heaven and earth seem trembling with the noise. After the thunder will come hail, so fierce that scarcely you'll endure it and live, for the hailstones are both large and thick. Then the sun will shine again, but every leaf of the tree will be lying on the ground. Next, a flight of birds will come and alight on the tree, and never have you heard a strain so sweet as what they will sing. And at that moment in which their song sounds sweetest, you'll hear a murmuring and a complaining coming towards thee along the valley. And then you'll see a knight in black velvet astride a black horse bearing a lance with a black pinion, and he will spur his steed so as to fight you. If you turn to flee, he'll overtake you, and if you stay where you are, he'll unhorse you. And if you don't find yourself in that adventure, you don't need to seek it during the rest of your life. Well, I said goodbye to the black man and took my way to the top of the woods. And there I found everything just as I had been told. I went to the tree beneath which stood the fountain, and filling the silver bowl with water, emptied it on the marble slab. Thereupon the thunder came louder by far than I had expected to hear it. And after the thunder came the shower, but heavier by far than I had expected to feel it. For, of a truth, I tell you this, Kay, not one of those hailstones could be stopped by skin or flesh till it had reached the bone. So I turned my horse's flank towards the shower, and bending over his neck, I held my shield so that it would cover his head and my own. And when the hail had passed, I looked at the tree, and not a single leaf was left on it. But the sky was blue and the sun was shining, while on the branches were perched birds of every kind, who sang a song sweeter than any that has come to my ears, either before or since. And thus, Kay, I stood listening to the birds when, lo, a murmuring voice approached me, saying, O night, what has brought thee hither? What evil have I done to thee that thou should come so much to me? For in all my lands neither man nor beast that met that shower has escaped alive. And then from the valley appeared the knight on the black horse, grasping the lance with the black pennon. Straightway we charged each other, and though I fought my best, I was soon overcome, and I was thrown to the ground. And the knight seized the bridle of my horse and rode away with it, leaving me where I was, without even despoiling me of my armor. Sadly did I go down the hill again, and when I reached the glade where the black man was, I confessed to thee, Kay, it was a marvel I did not melt into a liquid pool, so great was my shame. That night I slept at the castle where I had been before, and I was bathed and feasted, and none asked me how I had fared. The next morning when I arose, I found a bay horse saddled for me, and girding on my armor, I returned to my own court. You know, the horse is still in the stable, and I would not part with it for any in Britain. But in truth, Kay, no man ever confessed an adventure so much to his own dishonor. And strange indeed, it seems that no other man I have ever met knew of that black man, or the knight, and the shower. Would it not be well, said Owen, to go and discover the place? By the hand of my friend, answered Kay, often do you utter that which you, with your tongue which you would have not make good with your deeds. In truth, said Guinevere, the queen, who had been listening, you are better hanged, Kay, that use such speech towards a man like Owen. I meant nothing, lady, replied Kay. Thy praise of Owen is not greater than mine. And as he spoke, Arthur woke and asked if he had not slept for a little. Yes, lord, answered Owen, certainly you have slept. Is it time for us to go to meat? It is, lord, answered Owen. And then the horn for washing themselves was sounded, and after that the king and his household went down to eat. And when they finished, Owen left them and got his horse and his arms. And with the first rays of the sun, he set forth and traveled through deserts and over mountains and across rivers, and all befell him which had befallen Kynon, till he stood under the leafless tree listening to the song of the birds. And then he heard the voice, and turning to look, found the knight galloping to meet him. Fiercely they fought till their lances were broken, and then they drew their swords, and a blow from Owen cut through the knight's helmet and pierced his skull. Feeling himself wounded unto death, the knight fled, and Owen pursued him until they came to a splendid castle. Here the knight dashed across the bridge that spanned the moat, and he entered the gate. But as soon as he was safe inside, the drawbridge was pulled up, and it caught Owen's horse in the middle, so that half of him was outside and half in, and Owen could not dismount and knew not what to do. While he was in this sore plight, a little door in the castle gate opened, and he could see a street facing him with tall houses. Then a maiden with curly hair of gold looked through the little door, and bade Owen open the gate. By my troth, cried Owen, I can no more move it from here than thou art able to set me free. Well, she said, I'll do my best to release you if you will do as I tell you. Take this ring and put it on with the stone inside your hand, and close your fingers tight. For as long as you do conceal it, it will conceal you. When the men inside have held counsel together, they will come to fetch you for your death, and they will be much grieved not to find you. I will stand on the horse block over yonder, and you can see me, though I can't see you. Therefore, draw near and place your hand on my shoulder and follow me wheresoever I go." Upon that, she went away from Owen. And when the men came out of the castle to look for him and did not find him, they were sorely grieved, and they returned to the castle. Then Owen went to the maiden and placed his hand on her shoulder, and she guided him to a large room painted all over with rich colors and adorned with images of gold. Here she gave him meat and drink and water to wash with and garments to wear, and he lay down on a soft bed with scarlet and fur to cover him, and he slept gladly. In the middle of the night, he woke up, hearing a great outcry, and he jumped up and he clothed himself and he went into the hall where the maiden was standing. "What is it? What is it?" he asked, and she answered that the knight who owned the castle was dead, and they were bearing his body to the church. Now, never had Owen beheld such vast crowds, and following the dead knight was the most beautiful woman in the world, whose cry was louder than the shouts of the men or the braying of the trumpets. Owen looked on her and loved her. "Who is she?" he asked the damsel. "That is my mistress, the Countess of the Fountain, and the wife of him who you slayed yesterday. Verily, she is the most beautiful woman in the world, and the woman I love the best." "Well," said the maiden, she shall also love you not a little." And then she left Owen, and after a while went into the chamber of her mistress and spoke to her. But the countess didn't answer her. "What ails thee, mistress?" inquired the maiden. "Why have you kept far from me in my grief, Luned?" answered the countess, and in her turn the damsel said, "Is it well for thee to mourn so bitterly for the dead, or for anything that is gone from thee?" "There is no man in the world equal to him," replied the countess, her cheeks growing red with anger. "I would fain banish thee for such words." "Be not angry, lady," said Luned, "but listen to my counsel. You know well that alone you can't preserve your lands. Therefore, you should seek someone to help you." "And how can I do that?" said the countess. "I will tell you," answered Luned. "Unless you can defend the fountain, all will be lost, and none can defend the fountain except a knight of Arthur's court. There will I go to seek him, and woe betide me if I return not with a warrior who can guard the fountain as well as he who kept it before." "All right, go then," said the countess, "and make proof of that which you have promised." So Luned set out, riding on a white palfrey on pretense of journeying to Arthur's court. But instead of doing that, she hid herself for as many days as it would have taken her to go and come. And then she left her hiding place and went into the countess. "What news from the court?" answered her mistress when she had given Luned a warm greeting. "The best of news," answered the maiden, "for I have gained the object of my mission. When would you like me to present the knight who has returned with me?" "Tomorrow at midday," said the countess, "and I will cause all the people in the town to come together." Therefore, the next day at noon, Owen put on his coat of mail, and over it he wore a splendid mantle, while on his feet were leather shoes fastened with clasps of gold. And he followed Luned to the chamber of her mistress. Well, right glad was the countess to see them. But she looked closely at Owen and said, "Luned, this nice knight has scarcely the air of a traveler." "What harm is there in that, lady?" answered Luned. "I am persuaded," said the countess, "that this man and no other chased the soul from the body of my lord." "Had he not been stronger than my lord," replied the maiden, "he could not have taken his life. And for that, and for all things that are past, there is no remedy." "Leave me both of you," said the countess, "and I will take counsel." And then they went out. The next morning, the countess summoned her subjects to meet in the courtyard of the castle and told them that now that her husband was dead, there was none to defend her lands. "So choose you what shall it be. Either let one of you take me for a wife, or give me your consent to take a new lord for myself, so my lands will not be without a master." At her word, the chief men of the city withdrew into one corner and took counsel together. And after a while, the leader came forward and said that they had decided that it was best for the peace and safety of all that she would choose her own husband for herself. Thereupon, Owen was summoned to her presence, and he accepted with joy the hand that she offered him. And they were married right away, and the men of the earldom did him homage. From that day, Owen defended the fountain as the earl before him had done, and every knight that came by was overthrown by him, and his ransom divided among his barons. In this way, 3 years passed, and no man in the world was more beloved than Owen. Now, at the end of the 3 years, it happened that Gwalchmai, the knight, was with Arthur, and he perceived the king was very sad. "My lord, has anything befallen you?" he asked. "Gwalchmai, I'm grieving concerning Owen, who I have lost these 3 years, and if a fourth year passes without him, I can live no longer. And sure am I that the tale told by Kynan, the son of Clydno, caused me to lose him. I will go myself with the men of my household to avenge him if he is dead, to free him if he is in prison, to bring him back if he is alive." Well, Arthur and 3,000 men of his household set out in quest of Owen and took Kynan for their guide. When Arthur reached the castle, the youths were shooting in the same place, and the same yellow man was standing by, and as soon as he beheld Arthur, he greeted him and invited him in, and so they entered the castle together. So vast was the castle that the king's 3,000 men were of no more account than if they had been 20. At sunrise, Arthur departed with Kynan for guide and reached the black man first and afterwards the top of the wooded hill with the fountain and the bowl and the tree. "My lord," said Sir Kay, "let me throw the water on the slab and receive the first adventure that can befall." "Thou mayest do so," answered Arthur, and so Kay threw the water. Immediately all happened as before. The thunder and the shower of hail, which killed many of Arthur's men, the song of the birds and the appearance of the Black Knight. And Kay met him and fought him and was overthrown by him. And then the knight rode away, and Arthur and his men encamped where they stood. In the morning, Kay again asked leave to meet the knight and to try to overcome him, which Arthur granted. But once more he was unhorsed, and the Black Knight's lance broke his helmet and pierced the skin right down to the bone and humbled him in spirit. After that, every one of the knights gave battle, but none came out victor. And at last there was only Arthur himself and Gwalchmai. "Let me fight him, my lord," said Gwalchmai as he saw Arthur taking up his arms. "Okay, fight then," said Arthur. And Gwalchmai threw a robe over himself and his horse so that none knew him. All that day they fought, and neither was able to throw the other, and so it was on the second day. On the third day, the combat was so fierce that they both fell to the ground at once, and as they fought back to their feet, at last the Black Knight gave his foe such a blow on the head that his helmet fell off. "I did not know it was you, Gwalchmai," said the Black Knight. "Here, take my sword and my arms." "No," answered Gwalchmai, "it is you, Owen, who are the victor. Take my sword." But Owen would not. "Just give me both your swords," Arthur said from behind them, "for neither of you has vanquished the other." And Owen turned and put his arms around Arthur's neck. Well, the next day Arthur would have given orders to his men to make ready to go back where they came, but Owen stopped him. "My lord," he said, "during these 3 years that I have been absent from thee, I have been preparing a banquet, knowing full well that you would come to seek me. Stay with me, therefore, for a while, you and your men." And so they rode to the castle of the Countess of the Fountain and spent 3 months resting and feasting. And when it was time for them to depart, Arthur besought the Countess if she would allow Owen to go with him to Britain for the space of 3 months. With a very sore heart, she granted permission, and so content was Owen to be once more with his old companions that 3 years instead of 3 months passed away like a dream. One day, Owen sat at meat in the castle of Carleon upon Usk when a damsel on a bay horse entered the hall, and riding straight up to the place where Owen sat, she stooped and drew a ring from off his hand. "You shall be treated the traitor and the faithless," she said, and turning her horse's head, she rode out of the hall. At her words, Owen remembered all that he had forgotten. And sorrowful and ashamed, he went to his own chamber and made ready to depart. At dawn he set out, but he did not go back to the castle, for his heart was heavy. And he wandered far into wild places until his body was weak and thin, and his hair grew long. The wild beasts were his friends, and he slept by their side. But in the end he longed to see the face of a man again, and he came down into a valley and fell asleep by a lake in the lands of a widowed countess. Now it was the time when the countess took her walk, attended by her maidens, and when they saw a man lying by the lake, they shrank back in terror, for he lay so still they thought he was dead. But when they had overcome their fright, they drew near him and touched him and saw that there was life in him. And then the countess hastened to the castle and brought from it a flask full of precious ointment and gave it to one of her maidens. Take that horse which is over there grazing and a suit of men's garments and place them near the man and pour some of this ointment near his heart. If there's any life in him, that will bring it back. But if he moves, hide yourself in the bushes and see what he does. The damsel took the flask and did her mistress's bidding. Soon the man began to move his arms and then slowly rose to his feet. But creeping forward step by step, he took the garments off the saddle and put them on and painfully mounted his horse. When he was seated and the maiden came forth and greeted him, glad he was when he saw her, and he asked where castle was near. It belongs to a widowed countess, answered the maiden. Her husband left her two earldoms, but it is all that remains of her broad lands, for they've been torn from her by a young earl because she would not marry him. That's a pity, said Owen, but he said no more, for he was way too weak to talk. And then the maiden guided him to the castle, kindled a fire, and brought him food. And there he stayed and was tended for 3 months, until he was handsomer than ever. At noon one day, Owen heard a sound of arms outside the castle, and he asked the maiden what it was. It's the earl of whom I spoke to you, who has come with a great host to carry off my mistress. Beg of her to lend me a horse and armor, said Owen, and the maiden did so, but the countess laughed bitterly when she answered, no, but I will give them to you, and such a horse and armor and weapons as you have never had yet, though I know not what use they'll do you. But perhaps it will save you from falling into the hands of my enemies. Well, the horse was brought out, and Owen rode forth with 2 pages behind him, and they saw the great host before them. Where is the earl? Said Owen. In yonder troop where the 4 yellow standards stand. Await me at the gate of the castle, said Owen, and he cried a challenge to the earl, who came to meet him. Very hard they fought, but Owen overthrew his enemy and drove him in front to the castle gate and into the hall. Behold the reward of thy blessed balsam, he said, as he bade the earl kneel before her and made him swear that he would restore all that he had taken from her. After that, he departed and went to the desert, and as he was passing through a wood, he heard a loud yelling. Pushing aside the bushes, he saw a lion standing on a great mound, and by it a rock. Near the rock was the lion seeking to reach the mound, and each time he moved up, darted a serpent from the rock to prevent him. So then Owen unsheathed his sword, and he cut off the serpent's head and went on his way. And the lion followed and played about him as if he had been a greyhound. And much more useful was he than a greyhound, for in the evening he brought large logs in his mouth to kindle a fire, and he brought down a fat buck for dinner. Owen made a fire, and he skinned the buck, and he put some of it to roast, and he gave the rest to the lion to eat. And while he was waiting for the meat to cook, he heard a sound of deep sighing close to him. And he said, Who art thou? I am Luned, replied a voice from a cave so hidden by bushes and green hanging plants that Owen hadn't seen it. And what do you hear? He cried. I'm held captive in this cave on account of the knight who married the countess and left her. For the pages spoke ill of him, and because I told them that no living man was his equal, they dragged me here and said I would die unless he comes to deliver me by a certain day, and that is the day after tomorrow. His name is Owen, the son of Urien, but I have none to send a message to him to tell me of my danger or of a surety, I know he would deliver me. Well, Owen held his peace, but he gave the maiden some of the meat and told her to be of good cheer. Then, followed by the lion, he set out for a great castle on the other side of the plain. And men came and took his horse and placed it in the manger, and the lion went after and laid down in the straw. Hospitable and kind were all within the castle, but so full of sorrow that it might have been thought death was upon them. At length, when they had eaten and drunk, Owen prayed the earl to tell him the reason for their grief. "Yesterday," said the earl, "my two sons were seized while they were hunting by a monster who dwells in these mountains, and he vows that he will not let them go unless I give him my daughter to marry." "That shall never be," said Owen, "but what form does this monster take?" "In shape he's a man, but in stature he's a giant," said the earl, "and it's better by far that he should slay my sons than I should ever give up my daughter." Early the next morning, the dwellers in the castle were awakened by a great clamor, and they found that the giant had arrived with the two young men. Swiftly, Owen put on his armor and went forth to meet the giant, with the lion following at his heels. And when the great beast beheld the hard blows that the giant dealt his master, he flew at his throat, and much trouble had the monster in beating him off. "Truly," said the giant, "I shall find no difficulty in fighting thee if it weren't for that lion." And when he heard that, Owen felt shame that he could not overcome the giant with his own sword. So he took the lion and shut him up in one of the towers of the castle, and he returned to the fight. But from the sound of the blows, the lion knew that the combat was going ill for Owen, and so he climbed up until he reached the top of the tower, where there was a door on the roof. And from the tower he sprang onto the walls, and from the walls to the ground, and with a loud roar he leapt upon the giant, who fell dead under the blow of his paw. Now the gloom of the castle was turned to rejoicing, and the earl begged Owen to stay with him until he could make him a feast. But the knight said he had other work to do, and he rode back to the place where he had left Luned, and the lion followed at his heels. When he came there, he saw a great fire kindled, and two young men leading out the maiden to cast her upon the fire. "Stop," he cried, "what charge do you have against her?" "Well, she boasted that no man in the world was equal to Owen, and we shut her in a cave and agreed that none would deliver her but Owen himself, and that if he didn't come by a certain day, she would die. And now the time has passed, and there's no sign of him. In truth, he is a good knight, and had he but known that the maid was in peril, he would have come to save her. But accept me in his stead, I entreat you," said Owen. "Okay, we will," they replied, and so the fight began. Well, the youths fought well and pressed hard on Owen. And when the lion saw that, he came to help his master. But the youths made a sign for the fight to stop and said, "Chieftain, it was agreed that we should give battle to you alone. It's harder for us to contend with that beast than with you." Well, Owen shut up the lion in the cave where the maiden had been held a prisoner and blocked up the front with stones. But the fight with the giant had sorely tried him, and the youths fought well, and they pressed him harder than before. And when the lion saw that, he gave a loud roar and burst through the stones and sprang upon the youths and killed them. And so Luned was delivered at the last. And then the maiden rode back with Owen to the lands of the Lady of the Fountain. And he took the lady with him to Arthur's court, where they lived happily till they died. And that's the story from the Mabinogion, the old Welsh fairy tales.
Ah. Very nice.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story because it's so typical of a lot of the Arthurian stories where the knight rescues a maiden and then forgets, goes away, and then has trouble. It's very like the Grail Knight when he goes to the Grail Castle for the first time and doesn't ask the right question. And so then he has to go off and have more adventures. It's sort of a story about, you know, the young man going out into the world and achieving something and then forgetting the source of, I guess you could say, his passion. And then reclaiming it again when he's older and wiser.
Very good.
Yeah.
Do you have a shorty?
No, I don't. Do you?
Well, you know, I was thinking about something else. I was thinking that it might be interesting
We want to give people some time to think about it and to talk about it. Maybe sometime either in late February or early March, maybe we should take an evening and let you do dream interpretations.
That would be wonderful if people want to call in, definitely.
So why don't we think about a date for that, and we'll send out some alerts.
Okay.
And if that sounds interesting to you people, please let us know.
Yes, most definitely. I would love to. It's so important for people to understand the need for dream, to understand their dreams.
Absolutely. Maybe you can even look at the sky and see if there's an auspicious day to reveal some important information to good people.
Okay, I will. We will find a time, definitely. Most definitely.
Well, my dear, as always, it's been a real pleasure.
Yes, it has been. I hope you all enjoyed the story of the Lady of the Fountain. I don't know, you know, those guys back then, whoever owns the water is in charge, isn't it?
Well, the water of spirit on this Aquarian night certainly will flow and flow and flow.
Most definitely. Okay, well, shall we say goodbye then?
I think that's appropriate, my dear.
Okay.
Why don't we do a little om for three rounds, and
okay,
then we'll call it a night.
Now, wait, before we go,
sure,
you should mention that you do a show on Sunday night.
That's right. That's right. For those of you with concerns and interests beyond the mystic and the timeless, I do a show Sunday evenings, 7 p.m. East Coast time, called Progressive News Network. And I've got some very interesting guests this week. The theme of this week's show is the Arab Spring.
Oh, fantastic.
And I've got some people who have backgrounds in that area, people who've studied that area, and it should be very interesting. In fact, one of my guests is a gentleman from Wales, from Cardiff in Wales, mm-hmm, who just written a book about he's collected tweets from literally thousands of people live from Tahrir Square, and he's put together a book about it. So he'll be talking, and I've got a woman from Turkey who has background and lots of interest in that area, and then another gentleman who is both Palestinian and Lebanese. So check it out. That'll be 7 p.m. East Coast time, and 6 and 5 p.m. West Coast time on Sunday, this coming Sunday. So maybe you'll join us for that as well. Thanks for mentioning it, Kat. Thank you very much.
Well, my pleasure. You do good work.
Well, thank you, my dear. So do you. So do you indeed. And with that, let me. Well, maybe we'll just close.
Maybe no ohms tonight.
Yep, that sounds good. Thanks so much, Kat, for all the work that you do.
So, merry meet and merry part.
And merry meet again.
See you next week at the Bard's Grove.
Indeed, indeed. Good night and sweet dreams, my friends.
You too.